Hey, so the usual rules apply. I'll tell you when the quizzes are done, you can come pick them up. So there's still some quiz twos and quiz ones left. I'll take the quiz twos into my office. And as I said, if you don't pick them up, I don't care. But the quiz threes will be out there as soon as they're done. So let's talk about option pricing. As I said, option pricing tends to be one of those things that's kind of mysterious. People do it all the time. They use models, but they don't understand the building blocks. And I said there are two building blocks for option pricing models. One is replication. The second is arbitrage. Let me repeat again what the process is. Fisher Black and Myron Schultz said, since you can create something that looks just like the option by combining the underlying asset, neither borrowing or lending, that has exactly the same cash flows, that's a replication, it has to trade at the same price. That's arbitrage. The easiest way to see option pricing play out is actually what's called an arbitrage pricing model. So let me show you what an arbitrage pricing, I'm sorry, with a binomial pricing model. Let me explain what a binomial pricing model is. Let's assume that prices follow a very simple process. At every point in time, they can jump to only one of two points. That's a binomial part. So let's say the stock price right now is 50. Next period, it can go to either 70 or 35. That's T equal to one. T equal to two, if it goes to 70, it can go to 100 or 50. If it goes to 35, T equal to two, it can go to 50 or 25. Right now, you're at this point in time, the stock is 50. Two periods from now, there are three different prices. The stock can be 100, it can be 50, or it can be 25. Very simplistic model, but let's assume I sold you a call option with a strike price of 4. And we're going to try to value that call option. So right now the stock price is 50. I'm selling you a call option with a strike price of 40. If you exercise the option right away, what are you going to get? What's your profit going to be? You're going to buy the stock at 40, sell it at 50. You're going to make $10, right? But you've got two periods to play the game. So it doesn't make sense for you to exercise. But let's carry it forward to T equal to two. If you take the option with the call option, if you take the $40 strike price, if the stock price goes to 100, you're going to make 60. If it goes to 50, you're going to make 10. And if it goes to 25, you're going to make minus 15. No, you're not going to make minus 15. Explain again why with an option, you're not making minus 15. What's going to happen if the stock price goes to 25? Dan?
When it expires out of the money, it's worthless.
You're not going to exercise the option. Why would you want to buy a stock at 40 if it's trading at 25? That's where the right comes in. So I know what the cash flows are going to be on this call option at T equal to 2. Here's what I want to do. I want to create a replicating portfolio that has exactly the same cash flows as the option by combining the underlying stock and either borrowing or lending. Because it's a call option, it's going to be borrowed. So let's go to the stock price when the stock price is 70. Stock price is 70. I know it can go to either 100 or 50. I know the call is going to be worth either 60 or 10. So I'm going to go out and borrow B dollars. For the moment, humor me because B is just an unknown. And I'm going to buy, you know, shares of stock. Let's call it delta shares of stock. Two unknowns. I don't know how much I'm going to borrow. I don't know how many shares of stock I'm going to buy, but I know what I want the cash flows on this position to be if the stock goes to 100. So 100 times delta minus 1.11 times B, if the stock goes to 100, has to be equal to 60, because that's what the call is worth. And if the stock goes to 50, 50 times D minus 1.11 times B has to be equal to 10. Remember high school, I don't know which grade you did this in, simultaneous equation, you have two equations, and two unknowns, you work hard enough and long enough, there should be no unknowns. That's what I do. I solve for the equation. And I end up with a delta of one and a borrowing of $36.04. You think, what does that even mean? If the stock goes to 70 and I go out and borrow $36.04 and buy one share of stock, I will create a position that is exactly the same cash flows as a call option, the strike price of 40. How much is that going to cost me? Well, one share of stock cost me $70. I borrowed $36.04. So from my pocket, I've got to come up with $33.96. It'll cost me $33.96 to create the replicating portfolio or the replicating position. And because you have arbitrage. You can't have a different price. The call option, if the stock price goes to 70, has to be equal to 33.96 as well. I go down to the stock price of 35. Here, the stock can either go to 50 or 25. If it goes to 50, the call's worth 10. If it goes to 25, it's worth nothing. Again, I ask the same question. How much will I borrow? And how many shares of the underlying stock? I go through the simultaneous equations again, and I have delta of 0.4 and B of $9.01. What does that mean? If I go out and borrow $9.01 and buy 0.4 shares of stock, and don't even ask me how you buy 0.4 shares of stock, let's assume you could, you will create a position that has exactly the same cash flows to call. That position will cost me $4.99. That then becomes the value of the call if the stock goes to 35. So I know what the call is going to be worth if the stock price goes to 33.96. I know what the call is going to be worth if it goes to the stock price goes to 435. It's $4.99. I move back in time to T0 and I ask exactly the same question. How much would I need to borrow? And how many shares of the underlying stock will I need to buy to end up with 33.96 if the stock goes to 70 or $4.99 if the stock goes to 35? And if I solve for that, turns out that if I borrow $21.61 today and I buy 0.827 shares of stock, I will create a position that replicates the call all the way through the life of the option. Because it'll be self-financing. Once I put that position together, if the stock goes to 70, it's going to be worth $33.96. I can fund the new replicating portfolio. Stock goes to 35, it's worth $4.99, which essentially funds that as well. That position right now would cost me $19.42. I have essentially created the replicating portfolio, and with arbitrage, that will then become the value of the call option today. Remember, you made only $10 by exercising today. What's the extra $9.42 for? That's the time premium on the option. The binomial approach to options came about 10 years after Black-Scholes. You know why it was created? Because people tried to explain Black-Scholes in classrooms, it was very difficult for people to see where the replication was and where the arbitrage was. The only problem with the binomial, first, I'm giving you a choice of only one of two prices at every point in time. Imagine a real stock in a real market. And think of all the possible prices that Twitter could go to in the next second. So I'm simplifying life by making it only two choices. To make that even a possibility, I've got to make time really short. If I make it a day, there's no chance. Maybe if I make it a millisecond, there's a chance it could be binomial. But then I face a second problem. Let's suppose I asked you to draw a binomial price distribution for an option with a 3-month life. And you decide to break 3 months down into seconds. Forget about milliseconds, into seconds. I'm going to ask you a rhetorical question. Don't give me a mathematical answer. How many seconds are there in 3 months? A lot of seconds, right? If you decide to draw a binomial tree with tiny little branches, let's suppose you get a magnifying glass out, you get a really sharp pencil and say, I'm going to draw a binomial tree. And you make these tiny branches and you draw the entire tree. Take a look at what that binomial tree will look like. It'll look like a really dense pine tree on its side, right? Basically, it's going to be tiny branches going down. Flip the tree over, hang in there for a moment. There's an end to the story. Flip the tree over on its base. So it's going to look like a triangle. Smooth out the outsides. You know what the triangle is going to look like? It's going to look like a normal distribution. If you take the binomial distribution as t gets really small, you make the price changes small. That's called a continuous distribution. The binomial distribution converges on the normal distribution over time. The Black-Scholes model is a limiting case of the binomial model. If price changes are continuous, they're small, as price changes, as time gets smaller, the binomial option pricing model becomes the Black-Scholes model. What do you gain when you get the Black-Scholes model? You no longer have to draw the tiny branches. You got the normal distribution. And a normal distribution can be characterized with an average and a standard deviation. That's what the Black-Scholes model buys you, but it does so at a cost. It's built on the presumption that price changes are continuous. Is that a good assumption though? Our price changes continue? Because I'll describe to you how the world would work if price changes were continuous. If you have a stock like Twitter trading at 43, you know how it gets to 40, 54? It goes 43, 4301, 4302. It moves in small increments. There are no price jumps in a continuous distribution. So right at the start, you can see it's an unrealistic assumption. But what does it get you? It gets you a normal distribution and makes your life simpler. So the original Black-Scholes was built on the normal distribution, but it's still built on replication arbitrage. And in the original Black-Scholes, the value of a call option is a function of five inputs. S, which is the value of the underlying asset, K, which is the strike price, R, which is the riskless rate, T, which is the life of the option, and sigma, which is the standard deviation, or sigma squared, which is the variance of the log value of the underlying asset. You know why we use log values? Because we take stock prices. What's the lowest value price can take? Can't drop below zero, right? The highest value can be. We want a normal distribution. To have any shot of getting a normal distribution, if you take the log of zero, you know what you get? You get minus infinity. It gives you a chance of using the normal distribution. That's why people, when they use Black-Scholes models, if they have to estimate volatility, if they want to do it right, have to use log prices. There are shortcuts you can use, which give you just as good an answer. But the original Black-Scholes was built on using log prices because it was built around the normal distribution. S, K, R, T, and sigma. But last session, if you remember, I said there were six variables that determine the value of an option. What's a missing variable? What does the Black-Scholes model not have?
Dividends.
It doesn't have dividends. You know why it doesn't have dividends? It was because when Black and Scholes were trying to solve for this model, they ran into a bit of a brick wall. They had the model set up, the equations written, but nobody in finance had ever seen an equation like this one. It required the use of what's called stochastic calculus. And nobody in finance does stochastic calculus. Rumor has it that a physics PhD at the University of Chicago was wandering by Myron Scholes' office, and he came in and looked at the equation and said, we do that all the time in physics. And he wrote out the solution from physics. And so the Nobel Prize should really have gone to Fisher Black, Myron Scholes, and an unknown PhD student in physics. But basically they were running into so much trouble that they said, let's act like there are no dividends. In fact, the original Black-Scholes was designed to value what are called dividend-protected options. You're saying, what's a dividend-protected option? Remember, the reason we worry about options is on the day the dividend is paid, the stock price drops at roughly the amount of the dividend, right? What if I could also adjust your strike price by exactly the same amount? You'd be protected. That's what the original Black-Scholes was designed to do. But the reality is there are no dividend protected options that I know of anywhere in the world. It's an unrealistic assumption, but it allowed them to solve for the original Black-Scholes. The original Black-Scholes, the value of the call, is the stock price today. It's not an expected future stock price. The stock price today times N of D1. And I'll come back and talk about the intuition behind what have N of D1 and N of D2 here. N of D1 minus KE minus RT. I tell people that when you first start using the Black-Scholes model, there are all these virgin buttons on your calculator that you've never touched. Exponential, natural log, all of those come into play because E minus RT is just the present value factor. KE minus RT is the present value of the strike price. Why? Because the original Black-Scholes, again, to simplify life, was designed to value what are called European options. Which is unfortunate because we've attached to geography. It's got nothing to do with geography. You have European options and American options. You know what the difference between the two options is? What sets European options apart? Yeah.
You can only execute on the
The last minute of the last day. You can exercise only at expiration. American options can be exercised anytime up to expiration. Forget about all the math. If I gave you two exactly equivalent options, one is a European option, but the other is an American option. Which one should trade for more? The American, because I give you everything that the European option has, plus the right to exercise early. 95% of the time, you might not use it, but So a Black-Scholes model is designed to value European option. It's not a huge problem because, as I said, it'll give you a lower bound. An American option can add on. You can modify Black-Scholes to reflect that. But basically, because you can't exercise till expiration, what the Black-Scholes model is saying is, look, you have to pay the exercise price, but not till 2 years from now, so we're going to take the present value. E minus RT is the present value factor. If you don't have an exponential button on your calculator, you can just take the strike price and take a traditional present value, and you get pretty close to the same number, times n of d2. Now let's talk about d1 and d2. D1 and d2 is this math. This is what throws people when they use the Black-Scholes. They say, what the heck is that? D1 and d2 by themselves are difficult to explain. They reflect all of the inputs. That's a stochastic calculus yielding d1 and d2. But I can give you some intuition behind n of d1 and n of d2. N of d1 and n of d2 are areas under the normal distribution. Usually when you see normal distributions in statistics books, it'll give you the height of the distribution. N of d1 is an area under the distribution. In fact, if you've ever seen an N of d1 table, it stretches from 0 to 1. You know what that tells me? N of d1 and N of d2 are probability measures. In fact, N of d2 in option pricing is called the risk neutral, as or is measured as a risk neutral probability that your option will end up in the money. Let me repeat that again. So when I say the N of d2 in this option is 0.75, I'm saying there's a 75% chance that S will be greater than K. That's something we're going to come back and use when we talk about real options, because that is something that you can actually use for economic significance or talking about what is the chance this option will actually pay off. So both N of D1 and N of D2 are probabilities that reflect all of the inputs. But embedded in the Black-Scholes is that replicating portfolio. Remember the binomial we solved for this as B and delta? In the Black-Scholes, it's in there, you just don't see it. If you look at a Black-Scholes model, here's what the replicating portfolio that comes out of the model is. If you go out and buy N of D1 shares of stock, that's called the option delta, and borrow the present value of the exercise price times N of D2, you've essentially created the replicating portfolio in the Black-Scholes model. So if you break the Black-Scholes model down, it tells you what the replicating portfolio is. If you've ever been around option traders, or worse still, option researchers, they use a lot of Greek words. Notice delta, gamma, theta. Everything in option pricing is about that replicating portfolio and how it changes as different dimensions change. So for instance, if the stock price changes, the option delta will change. If the life of the option changes, the option value, that's called the option theta. As the variance changes, the option value will change. That's called the option vega. So basically, every single aspect of option pricing is built around that replicating portfolio. And from a practical perspective, you might have heard of people trying to hedge option positions. The way you hedge an option position is you get the replicating portfolio, and then you create essentially a counterweight to the option, because you know that if you sell the replicating portfolio and you bought the option, you've effectively created a riskless position. So there's going to be this temptation to plug numbers into the Black-Scholes, get a value and walk away. But the real value of the Black-Scholes, if you start breaking down what the replicating portfolio is and what it tells you about where the value of the option is coming from. Any questions? So this table that you see there is the normal cumulative normal distribution table. It's actually a table that I would supply to you if you ever have to price an option in a final exam, because you can't use your calculator to get this. You can use a computer, because there is a cumulative normal distribution function in Excel. But on a calculator, it's almost impossible to get a cumulative distribution. So that table has to be an input if you're going to value an option. But this is to value an option where there is no dividend or there's complete dividend protection. And as I said, that's unrealistic. So I'm going to give you a version of the Black-Scholes that you're going to see more frequently in this class, because many of the options we're going to value are going to have dividend-like components that reduce the value. So for instance, if you own an oil reserve, every time you extract oil from the reserve, you're actually reducing the value of the reserve. If you own a patent and you wait a year to exercise the patent, you're giving up some of the value. That's like a dividend. And there's a version of the Black-Scholes that adjusts for dividends. It does make some simplifying assumptions to get there. But if you can tell me what the dividend yield is on the underlying asset, dividend yield would be 2%, 3%, whatever it is, I can create a version of the Black-Scholes where I take D1 and D2. You're wondering what the question mark is. For whatever reason, it seems to have taken the sigma and made it into a question mark. So that's really a sigma, wherever you see the question mark. So it takes the original version of the Black-Scholes and it brings in the dividend yield into the D1 and D2. So it's a dividend yield adjusted version of the Black-Scholes, and it allows you to value options on underlying assets which do have a dividend on them. So you don't need to really solve or derive an option pricing model, but you need to understand the basics of option pricing models if you want to use them in real options. Any questions on option pricing? So now there are people in option pricing who are purists. And when you use a Black-Scholes model, for instance, value real option, you're pushing the limits of the Black-Scholes model. Here's what. I told you the Black-Scholes model is designed to value European options, which means the option doesn't get exercised till expiration. One of the options we're going to talk about is the option to develop an undeveloped oil reserve. So let's say you have the rights to this reserve for the next 20 years. You have an option for the next 20 years. Would you want to wait till the last minute of the last day of the 20th year to start developing a reserve? That'd be a waste, right? Because you can't get all the oil out in a second. So the essence of real options is you almost always will want to exercise early if the option goes in the money. That's true for patents, it's true for undeveloped reserves. So the argument purists make is you shouldn't be using a Black-Scholes model. You know what, I agree. But I'll continue to use it anyway, and here's why. If I wanted to use a binomial model to value these reserves, what would I have to do? I'd have to draw these little branches for the rest of eternity. I will use the Black-Scholes model and accept the fact that I'm going to get a lower bound on the value, and I'm making assumptions about continuous prices that could get me into trouble, but the alternative of actually going through a binomial model is just horrifying. I just can't get to an end game. It's not worth it. In fact, if you take the binomial model, there are no probabilities in the binomial model, but you attach probabilities to the branches, you get what's called a decision tree. If you don't want to use option pricing models, you can actually arrive at roughly the same conclusion by using decision trees. The nice thing about decision trees is you're not bounded by two outcomes. You can have three choices, four choices. Now, the way option pricing models are like, they're intimidating. So when you present option pricing models to finance people, even if they're experienced finance people, their eyes glaze over. So I tell people, don't bring out option pricing models unless you absolutely have to. So if you go into a pharmaceutical company and you bring out an option pricing model, everybody is looking at the Black-Scholes model saying, I don't get this. Decision trees, though, everybody should be able to relate to. Statistics, it's probability, it's much more, much more intuitive. So if you can get to an option pricing value using a decision tree, why use an option pricing model in the first place? So file that away as something you could do. And this is actually an example of how a decision tree would work. Now I'm using a drug to treat diabetes. And essentially you're right here. You're trying to decide whether to develop the drug. And then it goes through each stage. So it's perfect when you have sequential risk as you do in a drug company. And you don't know what the outcomes will be. It allows you to kind of back into the value of the option through the decision trees and probabilities rather than using an option pricing model. So file that away. I'm not going to go through decision trees because that requires just basic statistics and probability. But often you can get the same values that you get with an option pricing model if you're willing to flesh out the entire decision tree. So now let's talk about the three tests that we're going to run in every real option that I'm going to present. So whenever I present a real option to you, the first question you need to ask is that really an option? Am I misusing the option pricing model? So I'm going to draw the payoff diagram so you can see the option. I need to tell you what the underlying asset is. I need to give you the strike price, describe the option. Second stop, you've got to make sure that this option has economic value. And remember the key word there, is there exclusivity? If there is, clearly there is an option value. If there isn't, there is no option value, but often you fall somewhere between those two extremes. And third, I'm going to ask, can I use an option pricing model to value this real option? And there, because I'm using either a binomial or a Black-Scholes, which is built on replication arbitrage, the underlying asset has to be traded, the option has to be traded, I need to be able to borrow and lend at the risk-free rate. You can see with each test, I'm raising the ante, and it's getting more and more difficult to meet the test. So we're going to go through a series of options, but let me lay out first how we're going to approach it. We're going to start by looking at options in projects, investments, valuations. Then we're going to move on to options in capital structure. How, when companies borrow money, there is an optionality in not going all the way up to your optimal debt ratio. And then we're closing off by looking at options when you look at distressed equities, equities in companies where there's a lot of debt and the company might not make it. So let's start with the first one, options and investments. When we do corporate finance classes, at least the very basics of capital budgeting, we estimate the cash flows in a project, we come up with a discount rate, we take the present value and we compute a net present value. And the rule is very simple, right? If the net present value is greater than zero, you accept the project. If it's less than zero, you reject the project. That's perfectly good advice, but I'm going to build on that. The fact that you have a negative net present value in a project doesn't end the discussion. If I now said, if I gave you the rights to this project for the next 10 years, how much would you pay for it? Even though the project has a negative net present value now, you might still pay for the rights because things can change. The net present value can become positive. That's your option to delay. We're going to start with that. We're going to use the option to delay to talk about why patents and non-viable technologies and undeveloped reserves for an oil company can be valued as options. Second stop, we're going to look at options to expand. What is that? Your initial project might have a negative net present value, but to the extent that it gives you the right to a second project, which right now is not viable, but could become viable in the future, you have an option to expand. That's the example I talked about last session when I talked about Marriott opening 10 hotels in China with a license to open 500 more if things work out. That second decision is the option to expand. And the third is the option to delay, which is if you enter into a long-term project and you start to see the cash flows come in well below expectations, it's nice to be able to walk away from your mistakes, because that essentially means you're not bound to getting those negative cash flows for the remaining life of the project. I'm going to argue that the option to delay, the option to expand, and the option to abandon, sometimes projects that look bad using a static analysis with traditional cash flows and NPV might be projects that you would still add onto your portfolio because the options tilt the scales. So let's start with the option to delay. As I said, when you do a project analysis, you take cash flows, you discount back at a discount rate, you come up with the net present value. All it tells you is that that project is not a good project today, that you shouldn't take it today. But if you get the rights to this project, things can change. Like what? The investment you might need to make, it could be a green energy project where technology changes the economics of the project. The cost might become much lower. It could be that the market itself is changing, that what looks like a small market today could become a big market in the future. So if you think about the rights to this project, what you have essentially is a bad project, but the option to delay means that this project could become a good project. So let me draw the payoff diagram for the option to delay and start delineating what the underlying characteristics are. So you have the option to delay. If you decide to take this project, there is an investment you got to make in the project. Right now, the present value of the cash flows are less than the investment. So it's an out of the money option. But you got 10 years to it. Over those 10 years, the present value of cash flows could actually change. The market could get bigger. You might be able to charge higher prices. If the present value of cash flows exceeds the initial investment, you're going to take the project and you're going to claim the net present value. Is it possible, though, that 10 years from now, you look back and say, I wish I hadn't bought the rights? Absolutely. In which case, what happens? You lose whatever you paid for the option. It's like any other out of the money option. There are no guarantees, but you buy it because there's a possibility that this project could become a good project. That's what the option value is capturing. So I'm going to use two examples to illustrate the option to delay. The first is when you get a patent and if you're familiar, the way the US and around the globe, increasingly countries have bought into it, is with a patent, you get the exclusive rights to do something for the next 15, the next 18, the next 20 years. Rights, not obligations. So once you file a patent, you're not required to produce a product. So let's assume that you have a product patent and it's going to cost you whatever that's, 100 million, 10 billion, whatever it's going to cost you to develop the patent into a commercial product. Let's say you do a capital budgeting today based on what you know about the product today, and you come up with the present value of cash flows of V. If V is less than I, the present value of the cash flows is less than the cost of developing the spend into a commercial product, you're not going to develop it. It wouldn't make any sense. You're going to sit and wait. Remember, you have 15 or 18 or 20 years left in the plan. If V stays below I for the rest of the 15 or 18 or 20 years, you throw it in the trash can and say, I wish I hadn't bought that option. But if V increases over time above I, at some point in time, you will exercise the option and claim the net present value. You could make this patent, you can make it a technology. Essentially, I'm saying you can have a non-viable technology or a bad project today, but the rights to that project can still have value because things can change. So the underlying asset here is the project that comes out of the patent, or the product that comes out of the patent. The choice of when you develop it, the contingency is going to come about if the cost of introducing the product becomes less than what you get as present value of cash flows. But of course, if that never happens, what do you lose? You lose whatever you paid to acquire this patent. What are the two ways companies acquire patents? One is you can obviously buy them. The other is? But 90% of patents don't come through acquisitions. It comes through R&D. One way to think about R&D is what you're paying to acquire options. That's what a pharmaceutical company's R&D does. It churns out options. Of course, if all your options end up being out of the money and never come in the money, you're going to end up, that's bad R&D. But essentially, that's one way to think about why companies do R&D. It's to create options that you hope will have value in the future. So let's look at how you would get the inputs to actually value this option. Everything I do in terms of trying to price an option, I'm going to go back to an option pricing model and state it in terms of the inputs I need in an option pricing model to value the option. If I can somehow come up with these inputs, I should be able to value a patent, a non-viable technology, a license, anything that's not viable today, but could be viable in the future. So ready? You've got a patent on a product, and I'm going to try to value it an option. What is the underlying asset? It's a product that comes out the patent, right? So when I ask you, what is the S? What is the value of the underlying asset? You're going to take the present value of the cash flows from developing the patent today. Don't do any forecasting. Ask yourself, if I develop the patent today, what would the cash flows look like? It's like a traditional capital budget. What you get as a present value will be S. And while you're doing this, you're complaining to me. You know what you're complaining about? I feel so uncertain. This is a patent. It's a new product. And I'm going to tell you that's a good thing. That sounds like a weird thing to say, but this is going to help you that you're uncertain. So S becomes the present value of the cash flows from developing the patent today. K becomes the strike price, is the cost of actually developing the patent. So the factory might have to build, or the commercial setup you got to set up. That becomes the K in the model. Is it possible that K is greater than S? Absolutely. It's a patent, it's a new product. Who knows whether it's viable today or not? Remember I told you the value that you get from the cash flows is you're going to feel uncertain. I'm now going to let you put a number on how uncertain you feel. The uncertainty you feel in that value becomes the sigma, or the standard deviation of this option. The more uncertain you feel about the future, the higher the standard deviation will be in that value. Now, of course, the question is, where do I get that? There are two ways you can get it. Remember the Monte Carlo simulations we did earlier on when we valued companies? In a Monte Carlo simulation, you run 10,000, 100,000 simulations. You get a value, but you also get a distribution of values. We did that for Exxon, for Royal Dutch. Okay? When you get a distribution of values, you can also give me the standard deviation of the distribution. So one way in which you can get the sigma here is run Monte Carlo simulations on developing the patent and give me the standard deviation you get across those values. So I've got the S, I've got the sigma, I've got the K. How long does this option last? You get a patent, you don't get it in perpetuity. In the US, I think it's 18 years, 20 years, whatever it turns out to be. At the end of the 20th year, it becomes fair game. Everybody else can enter the business. So the life of the option becomes the remaining life of the patent. And there's one more thing to factor in. Let's say that your patent becomes viable 1 year from now. You still have 19 years left. Part of you says, let's develop the patent. But the other part of you says, let's do some more homework. Let's assess how good the project is. So there's this trade-off. Should I wait or should I develop? And I'm going to introduce a trade-off here. If you wait, you might potentially increase the value of this product by knowing more and getting a bigger market. But if you wait, what do you lose? Remember, you have 19 years of protection left. By waiting, you lose one out of the 19 years. You give up some of the protection you have on the patent. That becomes like a dividend yield to bring into the market. So let's actually take an example of a real patent. And this is very difficult to get when you're in the outside of a company because much of this is internal information. A company, I just got lucky here. It's a company called Biogen. It's a fairly large biotech company now, but when I did this, it was a small biotech company. And it had a drug working its way that had worked its way through the pipeline that was very close to approval, but they'd patented. It's a drug called Avonex to treat MS, potentially a big market. And what I got lucky on is I got my hands on a capital budgeting project analysis that the company had done on developing this drug. If you've ever seen a pharmaceutical company estimate cash flows on a drug, it's kind of a scary and morbid process because here's what they did. They estimated the number of people in the US, they projected initially they were going to sell the drug only in the US, the number of people in the US who suffered from MS. And they got a pretty good number. Then they estimated what percentage of those people go to a doctor, and it's not 100%. So you could have MS, you never go to a doctor, nobody diagnoses, you just slip through the cracks. So let's say 90% of those people go to a doctor. Then they estimated what percentage of those people get the right diagnosis. And guess what? That's not 100% either. This is the scary part. So let's say 90% of the people who go to a doctor actually get diagnosed. So now you've gone from 100 to 90 to 81%. Then they look at what percentage of those people get assigned a drug to treat the MS. You're saying, why wouldn't everybody get it? Because you have insurance, you have health, the healthcare costs, and it could be only 60% of those people end up actually being on the drug. So that brings the market down to about 60% of 81%, now brings you down to 48%. Then they estimate a price they're going to charge for the drug. And that's a choice, right? They can set it at a really high price, but that'll lower the market. Because if you set it too high, only 20% might take it, and they estimate revenues. So they'd all gone through this process, estimated cash flows. The present value they got for the cash flows was $3,422 million. So think of that as the value of developing the drug today. Avonex, Biogen had never actually developed a drug on their own. They'd been around, but they'd licensed drugs out to other pharma companies. Because actually producing a drug is a very expensive process in the US. It's not just the manufacturing. You got to set up sales teams. You got this whole infrastructure has to be set up. And they estimated that the cost of doing that for Avonex would be $2,875. So let me pause right there. If you develop the drug right now, you get $3,422 million. The cost of developing this drug is $2,875 million. If I take the difference between those two numbers, which is $547 million, what have I just solved for? What is it? So I've taken the present value of the cash flow, subtract out initial investment. That's a net present value, right? That is the NPV of this project, is $547 million. File that away because I'm going to create some magic here. Remember, they haven't developed the drug yet. They have 17 years left on the drug. So they could wait. What will they gain by waiting? They can check for side effects. They can check to see if they can make the market bigger. And let's say the uncertainty they feel about the 3,422 is an estimate, right? You could be wrong in the cash flows. I could have done a Monte Carlo simulation here, but I don't know enough about MS and how doctors behave to actually build that. So I cheat. To get an estimate of how uncertain I felt about the value, I looked at publicly traded biotech companies, and that's the cheating part. and I looked at the standard deviation of their stock prices. And it turned out that the standard deviation in stock prices, or the variance in stock prices of publicly traded biotech companies is 0.224. You see why this is cheating? Because what I want is the uncertainty I feel about the present value of cash flows. I'm using the variance in stock prices as a proxy for that uncertainty, but it saves me a ton of time. If I could do a Monte Carlo simulation, I'd probably get a much more sensible number, but I'd need a lot more information to get the distributions going. So I've got 17 years left on this option. I've got an S and a K that suggests it's viable today. And if I wait, I know I'm going to lose one of the 17 years protection. So I'm going to treat that like a dividend yield. I'm giving up that value if I wait. I have all of the inputs for a Black-Scholes model. If I plug in the values D1, D2, N of D1, and N of D2, the value that I get for Avonex valued as an option is 907 million. And if you have MS, this should terrify you. Because here's what you face, right? If Biogen develops a drug right now, the NPV is 547 million. If it waits and treats it as an option, it's worth 907 million. And what's the rule with options? Don't exercise if the option has value. And why should this matter to you if you have MS? You've been waiting for this drug for 10 years. It is viable, but the company chooses to wait because it thinks the upside you're awaiting exceeds the whatever you give up in terms of value. I'll give you the good news though. Biogen did develop the drug almost instantaneously. And I'll tell you why it probably happened. Here, what am I assuming the cost of delay is? One out of the remaining 17 years, right? But you see what the problem, that assumption is? I'm assuming that there's no other pharma company out there working on a drug to treat MS. What if I told you that Merck was working on a drug and it's going to come out in 4 years? I have a 4-year lead time, but they're going to, you know what my cost of delay will then become? So being 1/17, I really have only 4 years of protection. It's going to become 1/4. If I make the cost of delay 25%, the value of the option drops below 547 million, I would exercise it. Here's the bottom line. If you live in a competitive pharmaceutical sector, you're going to see drugs develop much more quickly because there is a cost to waiting. The cost of waiting is high because somebody else might develop a drug. But if you're a monopoly pharmaceutical company and you look around the horizon and nobody else is going to develop a drug for the next 18 years, you will wait, because it costs you too much, or you're giving up too much value by developing the drug right away. In fact, what I did here was actually calculated how long, if there are no competition at all, that they wouldn't develop the drug for almost 8 years. So each year I recalculated the value of the option. And if they have no competition, they would actually wait 8 years before they develop the drug. And that's what I meant when I said it's really bad news if you have MS. Because the drug is out there, it's viable, but they're choosing to wait because there's no competition, and what they give up by exercising early is too much relative to what they get. One final piece of this puzzle: Biogen, as I said, already had drugs out there, but they'd licensed the drugs out. In fact, if you gave me a pharmaceutical company and you asked me to value, the traditional way of valuing it is to project out the revenues and the cash flows, and some of your value from a company is value the entire company. But let's say I wanted to build up to the value in a different way. I can actually value a pharmaceutical company in three slices. The first is the value of the commercial products that they already have out there with a traditional discounted cash flow valuation. The second is you value the existing patents, which have not been developed as options. And the third is, remember that they have an R&D department that's continuing to churn out patents. You could say, what's the value of that added slice? I'll tell you upfront, I would not use this on a Pfizer. Can you imagine how crazy you'd drive yourself if you took, you know, all of the patents, because you probably have hundreds of patents, and tried to do an option on each one and then try to validate it. But if you gave me a small pharma company with one big drug that's just been approved on which they have a patent and one commercial product, this approach actually will give you a better answer, because you're breaking the drug down, the company down, into its constituent parts. The big question is, how do you value R&D? So I'm going to give this a shot with Biogen. there are two existing drugs at the time that I did this valuation. One to treat hepatitis B and another drug called Intron that they licensed out to other pharma companies. When you license out a drug, there are two ways you can license it. One is you can get a fixed license fee from the company, or you can get a percentage of revenues. The way Biogen had set it up is they got a fixed license fee. In fact, their collective cash flows from the licensing on these two drugs was expected to be $50 million a year for the next 12 years. It's contractually set. So what's the only risk that Biogen faces on these cash flows? It doesn't worry about revenues or how much they are. It worries about default risk on the part of whoever has licensed the drug from them. So to value this 50 million, I took the 50 million, discounted back at the pre-tax cost of debt of the licensing companies. You see why I had to use the pre-tax cost of debt? Because these cash flows are like bond payments. They're contractual payments. Don't be so quick to jump on the cost of capital as your discount rate for every single cash flow. In fact, let me ask you a question. If Biogen had licensed this drug to Medicare and the government had promised to pay $50 million a year for the next 12 years, what would you use as your discount rate? You would use the risk-free rate. It's the guarantor's risk you worry about here because that's what determines the value. So the present value is $397 million. So I've got the value of Avonex, which is their only patent, valued as an option. I've got the value of their existing drugs, $397 million. What's the last piece? I'd like to value Biogen's continuing R&D. And here I have to make a couple of assumptions. I first assumed that I could project out what the R&D expense would be for the next 10 years. So the R&D expense in the most recent year was $100 million. I assumed it would grow at 20% for the next 10 years and 5% thereafter. So I projected out the R&D expenses. What's the value of R&D? What's the value of any investment? It's the net present value that investment added on, right? So if your R&D earns a return on capital equal to its cost to capital, you know what added value comes from R&D? Zero. So all I had to do to value R&D is make a judgment, and I'm not saying it's easy to do, on what the return on capital would be. So basically, I assume that every dollar invested in R&D would generate $1.25 in value, which turns out to be a return on capital about 3% above the cost of capital. That then is all I need. But there is a substantial amount of uncertainty whether I can pull it off. So let's say the discount rate for this stream is 15%. So there's my R&D cost, growing at 20% for the next 10 years and 5% thereafter. There's the value of the patents that come out of the R&D. That's an expected value of $1.25 for every dollar invested. So there's my value patents. The difference is the added value. And beyond year 10, I assume they earn their cost of capital. So I ignore the added value after year 10. You take the present value of that added value. I estimate the value of Biogen's continuing R&D to be $318 million. So I have three pieces to Biogen. I have Avonex, $907 million. Their existing products licensed are $397 million. And the value of future R&D, the value that I get for Biogen's operating assets is $1.62 billion. Then I do add cash, subtract out debt. So it's a different way of arriving at the value of operating assets for a patent or a pharmaceutical company. But you can see it's a lot more work. And if you have dozens of patents, don't even go down this path. Don't ever use this approach for big pharma companies. It'll drive you crazy. So if you have a small pharma company with a single drug or two drugs, and you want to value them separately and add them together, it's perfectly okay. So I'll stop there. And next session, we're going to talk about using the option to delay to value undeveloped reserves.
How did the Marriott slides go?
It's 2 days after the it's 11. No, it's actually in class. Yeah. Yeah.
I just hear her say it over and over.
Well, that's what I was last I mean, if you go the next week, I can understand people.
I know,
this is 2 days after the last week. So, unless you're planning to miss the last week, I mean, I don't. So were you planning to leave on the 10th? Is that what you were saying? I would say book it after that.
Yeah.
I prefer you take it in person.
Yeah,
because I can't have people flying off to different parts of the world on the 9th. So, you know, if given that it's so close to the last class, I prefer that people take it in
person. I feel like you're pretty, like, you're like,
yes.
Yeah. Yeah, you're like basically working.
Yeah. See, it's no effect in the value, so why would your value change? The price has changed.
Yeah.
Nothing has changed, nothing fundamental has changed. It's not like he's given a specific plan on what he wants to do. So there's nothing I would see that would change in the basic intrinsic value model. Why would the cost of capital change? He's not taking it private. It's a privately held business. He's taking it private, but he treated it like a publicly traded company. So there's no total beta calculation. Nothing there is going to change. So not really.
No, for this.
Yeah. Hey, Dan. Absolutely. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
This is for you, right?
Yeah. Actually, my son.
It's doing well.
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks so much.
Good to see you. Take care. Thank you.